Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's remarks at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where he needled the press, noting that Donald Trump had entered the presidential race to promote his hotel business, and look at where he is today thanks to all the free publicity the press has given him. Award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, and NBC, Mark Feldstein, chair of journalism at the University of Maryland, joins us to discuss the press as enablers of Donald Trump, who, like Ben Carson, entered the primaries to promote his business brand, but because of his headline-grabbing antics, has received as much as $2 billion worth of free press, which the president gently reminded the press corps last night is astounding, if not disgraceful. Then we'll get an update on the political landscape in Indiana, where Ted Cruz is making his last stand to stop Trump on Tuesday, and speak with Marjorie Hershey, professor of political science at Indiana University, whose research focuses on political parties, campaigns, and elections. She joins us to discuss the almost comical nature of the Hoosier pandering, with Cruz referring to the basketball ring instead of the hoop, and Trump introducing coach Bobby Knight, who praised the Republican frontrunner as one who, like Harry Truman, would have the guts to drop the atomic bomb. Then finally, we will discuss the importance of the Supreme Court in presidential elections with Lisa Graves, who was chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee. The executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, she joins us to discuss how this year's election is critical in deciding who will replace Supreme Court Justice Scalia and the accuracy of the HBO movie about Clarence Thomas, Confirmation, which portrays the Republican senators as ruthless and determined, while the Democratic majority leader of the Senate Judiciary Committee appears gutless as he sells out the star witness against a demonstrably unqualified candidate. And joining us now is Mark Feldstein, who's a professor and the Richard Eaton Chair of Journalism at the University of Maryland. For over two decades, he has been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, and NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. He's the author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Feldstein.
Great to be here, Ian.
And Mark, I think you could do an update on your book, The Rise of Washington's Celebrity Culture, based upon watching the White House presidential dinner last night, or the correspondents' dinner, I should say, where so much of the focus was on the red carpet, which is now, you know, something they borrowed from the Academy Awards with a lot of glamorous movie stars and all of the sort of celebrity journalists of the chattering class. What was your impression of last night's remarks, particularly by President Obama?
Well, Ian, you know, mentioning the red carpet reminds me of the old line that Washington politics is Hollywood for ugly people. And there's always been this kind of craven Hollywood envy that was on display last night with a lot of Hollywood stars on the arms of politicians. I thought it was funny, President Obama's jokes and that of the host, comedian, Larry Wilmore, and his comments on Trump, struck close to home and didn't elicit a lot of laughs by the journalists in the audience.
I wonder why. Let's play the clip of President Obama referring to Donald Trump and chastising the press. Let's play it now.
All right, that's probably enough. I mean, I've got more material. No. I don't want to spend too much time on the Donald. Following your lead, I want to show some restraint. Because I think we can all agree that from the start, he's gotten the appropriate amount of coverage befitting the seriousness of his candidacy. I hope you all are proud of yourselves. The guy wanted to give his hotel business a boost, and now we're praying that Cleveland makes it through July. Mm-mm-mm.
And that is President Obama before the White House Correspondents' Dinner last night, in a sort of polite way to remind the press that Donald Trump essentially started out just like Ben Carson did to enter the primaries to promote his business brand, and now, of course, is the front runner and has shown an extraordinary skill at grabbing headlines. And he has, according to one study, he has received as much as $2 billion worth of free press. So how do you explain that? Is it because, you know, this is the sort of Kardashian culture that we're in now, and Donald Trump is tailor-made for that audience?
Well, that's certainly true, but I think underlying even that is the fact that the news outlets in this country are corporations trying to turn a profit. And Donald Trump has brought the networks much higher ratings. He's an entertainer himself, you know, reality TV star, and he knows how, you know, every day to put out a tweet or say something that is so incendiary, it'll get people talking. And so the networks have indulged him and given him disproportionate coverage because it drives their ratings higher and their profits higher. And the same is true for, you know, other news outlets, radio, newspapers, and online. The eyeballs and the clicks go up at the mention of Donald Trump. And probably a lot of us here who are listening have to admit that, you know, with the latest outrageous thing he says, we'll click on to see what he said.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Feldstein, professor and the Richard Eaton Chair of Journalism at the University of Maryland. For over two decades, he's been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, and NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. He's the author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture. So, Mark, is that to say then that this guy could win? Because if he's discovered that this is the means by which to win the Republican nomination against a pretty long field, I believe that there are 17 candidates in total, and he's knocked them off one by one. There's no reason to assume that he can't knock off Hillary Clinton if she's to be the Democratic nominee. So is this just a sort of unstoppable juggernaut because Trump has figured out how to play the press?
Well, it's a great question, Ian, and the honest answer is I don't know. I mean, there was a time when, you know, all of the conventional Washington wisdom would have said it's impossible for him to win. His negatives are too high, and yet he has disproved that, you know, time and again during the primary season. You know, that said, his negatives are still very high, even among the Republicans, so far. And mostly he's won with, you know, pluralities, at least in the early primaries. You know, even I still think he's likely to lose to Hillary Clinton. But, you know, we're one heart attack away or one maybe nuclear or a terrorist attack from scaring people enough that he could become president. So I think we just don't know. And yes, he has used the news media in a way that I'm not sure any one has done in this way since maybe Joe McCarthy.
And in terms of the is there, do you think there's any takeaway? I mean, the reason I want to cover this is because for the longest time it occurred to me that this political process of primaries running for a president has been captured by people promoting their own brand. It was so obvious in the case of Dr. Ben Carson, particularly given that his campaign manager was his business manager, Armstrong Williams, and they made no bar. And in fact, he did a book tour in the midst of his campaign, so there was no mystery about his motives. And then Trump has always, it's always occurred to me that Trump was promoting his brand. That's all he's ever done, and that's in fact what he is—a brand. So And I talked to a journalist who actually did an interview with him recently for New York Magazine, who said Trump was absolutely astounded by the response he got, that he'd really, you know, sort of almost entered the race as a lark, and now he's the front runner. So something's clearly happened to our politics, and how much is it? Can it be attributed to what's also happened to our media?
Well, I think the media component can't be underestimated. You know, and this is not the first time the media has kind of fallen for demagoguery. You know, if you look at the case of Joseph McCarthy, and I wrote about this in my book, you know, they gave almost stenographic coverage to McCarthy's inflammatory and false charges of communist penetration of the U.S. government. You know, they were operating in the 1950s when news media wasn't very critical, and they just gave stenographic coverage. McCarthy accuses someone of being a communist. They would put that, you know, in the newspaper, get the denial from the other side, and feel like they'd done their jobs of providing both sides. But journalists' obligation is more than but getting both sides, it's getting to the truth. And when you have a liar, as McCarthy was, making stuff up, it's the media's job to get past that. And eventually they did, once public opinion started turning against him. But one of the things I've found in my research, which I don't think has been out anywhere before, is that McCarthy's original speech, claiming to have a list of 205 people who were communists, who were working in the State Department. It was a laundry list from the hotel he was staying at in Wheeling, West Virginia. He was just waving that. It was a complete, it wasn't even the list he claimed to have, which he never had.
Good Lord, an actual laundry list.
An actual laundry list, but right. Not a communist. Just right. What got washed.
Amazing.
Clothes.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Mark, let's talk about the at the end, Obama, before he sort of said Obama out and dropped the mic. You did talk about the role of the press, and quite often that's sort of a ritual, where, because it is the press's moment in the sun, and usually the presidents, you know, talk about how important the press is to our democracy, etc. But Obama talked a little bit about stuff that I've been concerned about for a long time, and that is how the truth is a moving target, and how who spins the truth the best wins the argument, and that we need to have a consensus on what is true, otherwise we can't function as a society. And, you know, implying you've got all these anti-science biases coming from the religious right, you've got the global warming deniers who are given equal time because that's the way our media operates, you know, this sort of binary false comparison that is the ritual. What did you think of those closing remarks, even though, this is the same press that's elevated Donald Trump?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Ian, and I think he was trying to appeal to the news media's higher and loftier ambitions for itself by singling out the Boston Globe reporters who were the object of the movie Spotlight, who exposed pedophilia in the Catholic Church, by spotlighting the Washington Post reporter, brave reporter who had been imprisoned in Iran for some time. He was appealing to the better angels of the news media's nature, and I think trying to remind them of what their public service obligations are. Not that I think that's really going to matter, because you know, the profit motives are what they are for these corporations. There is one other thing I just want to, you know, point out at the risk of stating the obvious that shouldn't be ignored. As powerful as the news media has been in Trump's rise, you know, in their role as enablers, I also think that wouldn't have happened if there weren't so many people who are hurting economically. And clearly, both with the support for Bernie Sanders and for Trump, we are seeing a large, mostly white and working class that's really hurting as jobs go vanish and their skills are obsolete, and the desire for real change is there, and that can be taken advantage of by demagogues as well as by insurgents with more substantial platforms. And so, you know, even with all this coverage, I don't think Trump would have resonated this way were it not for this this economic hangover that we're still having from not only the Great Recession, but really the changes in the economy over the last generation.
Well, Mark Feldstein, I thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure as always, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Feldstein. He's a professor in the Richard Eaton Chair of Journalism at the University of Maryland. For over two decades, he's been an award-winning investor correspondent for CNN, ABC, and NBC, and a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. He's the author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the election desperation in Indiana. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Professor Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana University in Bloomington. Her research focuses on political parties, campaigns, and elections, and she's the author of Party Politics in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marjorie Hershey.
Thank you.
And the state of Indiana, of course, is in the political crosshairs at the moment in this make or break primary season, particularly for the Republicans and in particular for Ted Cruz, who's campaigning furiously in the state. Hillary Clinton actually is showing up there too today along with Bernie Sanders. But I don't think either those races are quite as well. Perhaps you could argue that the Clinton-Sanders race is pretty tight and make or break. But let's focus on Ted Cruz. It didn't help him in the Hoosier state to refer to the basketball hoop as the basketball ring. And President Obama
did get quite a bit of attention around the state.
I imagine Obama made fun of it last night at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So, but then on the other hand, you have Donald Trump trucking out the famous basketball coach Bobby Knight, who then showered Trump with praise by likening him to Harry Truman and how Harry Truman dropped the bomb on Japan. And it was like, is he really suggesting that we need Trump to be our president so that he can go nuking everybody around the world? What did you make of that?
There, a long time ago, after Bobby Knight was caught in one of his many incidents of questionable conduct, Joe Garagiola had written in a column in Newsweek that one of the things we learned from all of this was that it is possible to be a terrific basketball coach and a lousy human being. And after that, actually, the next endorsement that Mr. Trump got that he apparently valued highly was that of Mike Tyson, who, as you recall, was jailed for a time for raping a woman in Indiana. And Trump's response to it was that he likes strong, powerful people to endorse him. So, it's difficult to imagine a presidential race weirder than the one we've got right now. I'm sure it could be happening, and it probably will at some point in American politics, but it takes some effort.
But it seems to be the main issue that Cruz is trying to distinguish himself from Trump with is this business about, this obsession the Christian right has about bathrooms, and the fact that Trump made actually probably one of his more sensible remarks that, you know, people can decide what bathrooms to enter, you know, based upon their personal preference, as opposed to this idea that Cruz has got that, you know, young kids are going to be corrupted, if not abducted, from bathrooms. So how's that playing in the state, and why would he be focusing on that? Is it pandering to the Christian right?
Well, you know, it's interesting that so far in an awful lot of primaries and caucuses, evangelical Christians have been the majority of voters on the Republican side. So it's not without some basis in reasonable fact that Cruz is spending a lot of time on evangelical issues, and particularly in the state of Indiana, we've had quite a battle over the last couple of years over a Religious Freedom Restoration Act that was passed and then amended last year after a number of groups announced that they would boycott Indiana for their various meetings. This year, there was a Republican state legislator, certainly as a conservative, who took a crack at trying to generate some sort of protection for LGBT persons in civil rights legislation in the state, and said he just finally totally gave up because there wasn't any point of compromise whatsoever with those legislators, and we have a veto-proof Republican majority here in both houses in the state of Indiana to be able to come to agreement on anything. So there certainly is a base here for, and it's the same base as Governor Mike Pence, who kind of endorsed Ted Cruz a couple of days ago. He said he would plan on voting for Ted Cruz. So that base does exist, and it does come out to vote with some frequency in primaries and caucuses on the Republican side. So it's not delusional. You know, these folks are out there, and there are a lot of them, and they do come to the polls.
And again, I'm speaking with Professor Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana University in Bloomington. Her research focuses on political parties, campaigns, and elections, and she is the author of Party Politics in America. So do you think then that he's on the right track, that somehow this issue of bathrooms, the idea that, you know, you could go into a public toilet as a straight person and come out as a gay person or a transgender person or whatever. I'm not sure what the problem is, frankly, but is it playing? And do you think having Carly Free Arena there as his, where he made his announcement in Indiana with Carly Free Arena as his vice president, of course, she was famous in the debates for simply making up stuff about a fetus on a coal slab twitching and challenging Hillary Clinton to watch the video that didn't exist.
Well, my sense is that it's not as though Carly Fiorina is either well-known or well-liked in Indiana, but that Cruz is at the point in his campaign where he really has virtually no chance of getting the Republican nomination, and so he's looking for some means of shaking up the race so as to just, you know, the old story of throwing mud at the barn wall and the hope that one pack will stick, that might have changed the direction of the news coverage of him for a while, and it certainly did for a while. It also generated an awful lot of humor around here. One of my graduate students said, oh, yeah, the result of Carly Fiorina being named his vice presidential candidate is that now she's going to fire most of the people in his campaign. But I really think that it's just extraordinarily unlikely that Senator Cruz could get the nomination, and so he is just basically trying to expand his base of support. And with respect to the so-called bathroom bill, which has been introduced in a number of legislatures around the country, and it's not an accident that it has been introduced in the same form in a number of legislatures, this is kind of like what gay rights was a number of years ago, in which an awful lot of people didn't realize that they knew gay people because those gay people were closeted. An awful lot of people probably know a transgender person but don't realize that he or she is a transgender person. So we get these images in a lot of people's statements about how they could imagine somebody with a very bulky physique and a beard, you know, wearing a dress, going into a girl's bathroom and somehow discovering an unaccompanied small child there and molesting her. If they saw actual transgender people, they would probably have a better understanding of what the situation is. But it's just the product of unfamiliarity. It's like what happened when a Supreme Court justice a number of years ago had considered writing an opinion with respect to gay rights and said to one of his clerks, you know, the thing is, it just occurred to me that I don't think I've ever met a gay person. And the person he was talking to, his own clerk, was gay. It just didn't occur to him because he simply lacked the understanding that this is something that's much more common than he realized.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Marjorie, what is the story then with your governor there in Indiana who gave this incredibly lukewarm endorsement of Ted Cruz? He himself, I think, was thinking of running as well, joining the pack of 17.
Yeah.
But then he got into trouble over a similar bill, didn't he? So
he did. Governor Pence has long been closer to an evangelical Christian than a non-evangelical Republican. His issues are primarily those of traditional values and social issues. And I think his endorsement of Senator Cruz has a lot more to do with Mr. Pence's own rather vulnerable status for re-election as governor than it does anything else. Governor Pence lost a substantial amount of support over the past 2 or 3 years, not just with respect to the extent to which he favors a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which it very much goes against the business-oriented Republicans in the state, who are very concerned that if such a law were passed and if it generated the perception that Indiana was not open to a variety of different kinds of people, that they would have, the business leaders would have a lot of trouble recruiting. Even if they weren't recruiting people who were LGBT, they would nevertheless run into trouble recruiting people who were accustomed to living in more tolerant communities and who wouldn't want their children raised in an area where that kind of tolerance wasn't shown. So the Republican Party has had some mixed feelings about Governor Pence over the last couple of years. He's done some serious damage to the state budget, for example, by deciding that we needed to expand our public and private school voucher program so that families who wanted to send their children to private schools, including religious schools, could get state taxpayers' money to do so in the form of vouchers, and that voucher program has exploded in the past year. And people who are eligible include people who are higher income. So people who could very easily pay for their own child to go to a private school are nevertheless on the public till for being able to send their kids there. And that obviously has generated a lot of concern on the part of people who are in favor of public schools.
And understandably so. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you for giving us an update on this. It's not really a make-or-break situation for Ted Cruz, I guess, since you've pretty much said he's already past that point of no return. But, boy, if he doesn't have a chance, what about Kasich? You got to admit
this. Well, the interesting thing is our local newspaper reported this morning that Kasich, probably given that he comes from the neighboring state of Ohio, might kind of resonate better with an awful lot of people in Indiana than either Mr. Cruz or Mr. Trump. But Mr. Kasich's time is long over, and it sounds to me as though Mr. Cruz's is as well.
Well, Professor Marjorie Hershey, I thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Professor Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana University in Bloomington. Her research focuses on political parties, campaigns, and elections, and she's the author of Party Politics in America. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back discussing the difference between Republicans and Democrats in electing Supreme Court nominees. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. Then joining me in the studio is Lisa Graves, who is the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of alecexposed.org. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Ian, it's so nice to be on, and it's so nice to see you in person. This is a thrill.
Likewise. And I know that you've been very busy. And, of course, in this election year, you've, of course, were the first to expose Alec and the Koch brothers, so the Octopus, as it's called. Ironically, of course, it was just reported recently last weekend that I think it was David Koch is thinking of even supporting Hillary Clinton because they're so alarmed at Trump. Did that strike you as something of an irony?
Well, I had a lot of thoughts in response to that claim. I could share some of them with you. One of them is that, you know, the Kochs are engaged in a very significant PR campaign right now to try to pretend that they can be bipartisan, that they're not partisan, that they're not the shadow party of the Republican Party or really controlling it. And certainly the presidential race in terms of not necessarily getting their man, who we thought was Walker, as the front runner, has changed the dynamic. They certainly have expressed dissatisfaction, for example, with Trump. I think part of that, and Trump has expressed dissatisfaction with them, I suppose, because he can't necessarily be controlled by them or anyone else. But I think the Kochs are underplaying might be too mild of a term, but I think they're underplaying the role that they plan to play and, in fact, are playing in this election cycle. And, in fact, one of the most astonishing pieces of information that came out about a month ago was the Kochs pledged last year that they were going to spend $889 million of their own money and the money of their so-called freedom partners, these other billionaires, in this election cycle. And many people said, well, where is that money? We haven't seen it. Well, about a month or so ago at their big to-do in California, they told a reporter that they'd already spent about $450 million of it. Well, where has that money gone? That money has gone to groups that are basically lying in wait to spend that money, probably on attacking people in the presidential campaign once the general election comes around, and also on their broader agenda, which is to continue to try to control and dominate the state houses with governorships, Republican governors through the attorneys general, through state house races, through school board races. And so they're investing heavily in this election. And the idea that they're going to support Hillary is, that's certainly a talking point.
Right. But the money that you just talked about, close to $900 million, not that much shy of $1 billion that they raised or pledged at the big conclave they had in Newport Beach a couple of years ago that a friend of mine was able to get all the inside information on, and all the recordings of the agenda and speeches and who said what, that was all dedicated to stop Hillary. So how could they support Hillary if they've raised close to $1 billion to stop her?
Well, I have to say, having watched them and researched them and their statements over these past several years, I have to say that I have a high degree of skepticism about the truthfulness of almost anything they say, and also the deliberateness of some of the things they say. You know, for example, I'll never forget the interview that Jane Mayer did, the first really big story that she did about the Koch brothers, and David Koch had the audacity to say, "What Tea Party? I've never met a Tea Party person. I don't know what you're talking about." You know, that was a lie. They were absolutely funding the Tea Party, bankrolling it. David Koch's Americans for Prosperity was at the heart of that effort. Another branch of their former organization, the Citizens for a Sound Economy, that became FreedomWorks and AFP. FreedomWorks was also instrumentally involved in building up the Tea Party. And so I think they have shown over and over again their a capacity for dissembling, their capacity for misdirection. And in fact, Charles Koch had the audacity as well to claim that he only recently got involved in politics, but we know he's been involved in electoral politics for decades, and we have the documents to prove it.
So again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of ALEC Exposed. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. So in terms of campaign finance, obviously, I don't know whether you saw the 60 Minutes piece, I think it was last weekend, where they had this nice sort of earnest congressman, Republican, who wants to enact the STOP Act, you know, to stop being a telemarketer, which is what the system requires of all of them. And they showed, they even had hidden cameras going into the RNC call center just off Capitol Hill, where they go and they put them in these tiny little cubicles with a list of rich people to call in the district, and you got to at least come away with $1,000 per name.
Right.
I mean, this, you know, it's a humiliating process. And my sense is that if you make your politics all about money, then he who has the most money wins. And,
right.
And that, I think, is in essence the system we have. But look at what's happening with the money. I mean, all that money that went to Jeb Bush,
yeah,
there's got to be some buyer's remorse there.
Right.
All the money that's been gone to all those others,
right,
and the money that's now the people that tried to stop Trump, you know, our principals,
right,
that pack. What's going on? I mean, they are throwing money around, and my sense is that maybe there's just not going to be that much money in the general for Trump. Hmm. I mean, he's not going to spend his own, is he?
Well, no, I think that it's well, certainly there's a lot of dissatisfaction among members about this dialing for dollars and how the job of being a member of Congress has changed so much. They have to spend so much of their time, certainly the House members in particular, raising money for the next election, which is just right around the corner. And quite frankly, that distorts our public policy. It makes those people in Congress much more beholden to those major donors than people who can only give $20 or can't give a penny. It makes them much more beholden to, you know, multinational corporations, their lobbyists, and the CEOs that are funding them, writing big checks, much more beholden to them than their own constituents, the people who actually they are elected to represent in their own districts. You can see that the national level and also the state level with the American Legislative Exchange Council and those legislators, and how much more attuned they are to what the corporations want than what their own constituents want. But I think that it is an interesting phenomena that's happening in this past several months, which is, you know, there were billionaires that basically were the core constituency of Marco Rubio, and it didn't buy him the office. You know, that was a lot of money that went into pushing Marco Rubio. At one point, someone said he doesn't have very much backing, and I said, well, he's got a couple billionaires, and that's enough to keep you in the race for a number of months. And so I think they've bet on some of the horses and they haven't won. But these guys are really determined to try to win this presidency, win this White House, and really cement a right-wing majority on that Supreme Court. There could be up to 3 vacancies in this next cycle with this presidential race coming up for this first term of the next president. Those 3 seats could basically turn that court into basically the Roberts Court on steroids. So way beyond Citizens United, way beyond the incredible intrusive intervention in our efforts to address climate change, you know, taking down regulation, taking down rights of individuals, further reducing the power of Congress or administrative agencies to regulate dark money in elections, even disclosure. And so there's a big prize at the end of the day for them if they win this presidency, if they have their guy on the Republican side in that White House, and they get to basically ensure that court is captured for the next 10, 20, 30 years. Those are big stakes, and there's going to be a lot of money spent to come.
Right, but if that's the main priority, and I believe you, I think you've nailed it here, Lisa Graves. And my sense is that obviously they are in full panic mode because there are two problems. There's Donald Trump and the possibility that he could do so much damage to the down ticket that they could lose the Senate, and so they must be freaking out.
Yeah, I mean, I do think they are in quite a bit of panic, and you could certainly see a lot of those measures behind the scenes being broadcast in many ways in terms of the Stop Trump effort. And I think you also see a lot of showmanship going on right now with Paul Ryan, the sort of Hamlet routine of I'm not interested. Well, we've heard that song and dance before. That's what happened right before he became the leader of the House of Representatives. I think that there's certainly behind the scenes effort that we've heard about that is working to basically position him if Trump goes down, working to position Paul Ryan as the uniter of the party. And so I think there are a lot of machinations yet to come, but I do think there's panic because they can't control Trump because he's another billionaire like them. Although, as you point out, to the extent that he claims he's self-financing his campaign, it's a bit of a ruse since he's basically loaning his campaign money that will be paid back by other donors. So it's not really this completely self-financed operation. Of course, it's a deal, and a deal that Trump would benefit from, I'm sure, at the end of the day. So I think they are in a panic. But, you know, we haven't yet seen them unleash their full firepower on Hillary. They've left the Clinton Foundation alone. We know they're going to target that in a huge way in terms of her role at the State Department and the role of the former president, Bill Clinton, at that foundation and the type of money that was coming in. Clearly, they're going to continue to target her on Wall Street. And in this election cycle where you've got a lot of people left, right, middle who are extremely concerned with the continued capture of our political branches by Wall Street and corporations, you have a serious situation if you have an outsider candidate versus an insider candidate. And if you're on the Democratic Party side and you've got the insider candidate, you've got a lot of jeopardy as well.
Well, but you're really making a case, and it's always been a difficult case to make in a presidential election, or sort of, actually it's a perennial case. You've got to vote for our candidate because the Supreme Court's going to change. And that usually happens when you don't have a candidate who's got a sufficient interest in them, they're not sufficiently attractive, or you know, that's the sort of the final desperation, you know, vote for me because of the court.
Yeah.
And that's always been a depressing fact, and it's happened a lot, particularly on the Democratic side. My understanding is on the Republican side, they take the court more seriously. It's harder to get Democrats motivated over the court. But you've basically, so far, made an incredibly strong case that if ever there was a year where the Supreme Court was really the issue, this is it. Because on the Republican side, as you pointed out, if they can get their president in and hold on to the Senate, they can have their agenda for several decades to come in and build on the corporatist agenda that started by Roberts. I mean, you recall when the minute that Scalia died, Dow Chemicals decided to pay up a $1 billion fine because they lost their guy. That gives you an idea of the corporatist bent on this court. So it would go even further to the right. And then on the Democratic side, there is this promise by both Sanders and Clinton that if you elect me, I'll overturn Citizens United, which is considered, and Bernie Sanders has made a strong case, that unless you do that, all else doesn't matter to begin with. So I would say that there's an awful lot at stake here, and it all comes down to the Supreme Court.
Well, you know, I as someone who's worked on judicial nominations since 1997, 98, and worked in the Clinton administration vetting judicial nominees and as the staff leader of the team evaluating nominees for recommendation to the Attorney General in the White House, and then working for the Senate on judicial nominations, You know, I've heard a lot of talk over a number of elections about, you know, how important the courts are to the elections, and there's no doubt that they are. But I do think in this environment where you have this vacancy of Scalia, that's a swing seat right there. You have Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg, who are quite elderly, quite frankly, even though they seem vigorous. They were part of a deal that Orrin Hatch says he cut with the Clinton administration to get two Democratic appointees confirmed who wouldn't be on the court for very long. They were much older than the Republican appointees, than Roberts and Alito and Scalia and Thomas in their day. And so this is the sequence. This next president, whether it's a one-term or two-term presidency, will likely appoint at least three vacancies to that court, and it is really substantial. And I agree with Senator Sanders that Citizens United is in essence the core component of what's corrupting the people's control of over our democracy. There was already a lot of problems with our democracy before Citizens United in terms of corporate influence, lobbying influence, the growing lobbying class, the wealth disparity caused by a number of policies that were pushed into motion with the Reagan administration and moving forward. But the fact is that nearly every issue Americans say they care about, we can't get the work done. And we can't get the work done not just because of partisanship, but because that partisanship is driven by corporatism. The corporations do not want to have that, to have people be able to really have the type of influence that we should have in a democracy. It should be a democracy of the people, by the people, for the people, not a corporatocracy, and not, in the words of John Nichols and Bob McChesney, not a dollarocracy. But the corporations will be very happy to continue having a dollarocracy.
So what then is the do you see happening with Obama's nominee, who I guess what he's signaling to the Orrin Hatches of the world is this is the best deal you're going to get, you know, and if Hillary gets elected, her choices are going to be more liberal than this choice that we're offering up. And I understand that peeling it off a little bit. I mean, the whole thing was pretty unseemly that within an hour of Scalia's death, the leader of the Republican Senate, Mitch McConnell, came out and said, never, not on my watch, you know, pretty much what he said the day that Obama was elected.
Right.
This guy, my number one priority is to make him a one-term president. At least he doesn't disguise his motives. But that was before the body was cold. Yep. He laid down the gauntlet, didn't he?
Yep.
So, but how much have they been chipping away at that? What do you think is going to happen in this case?
Well, I think what you described is the gambit that President Obama is engaged in with respect to the nominee. The nominee certainly has the baseline qualifications for elevation to the Supreme Court in terms of the length of his judicial career. You know that the way that he has litigated over the course of time, a much different record than Clarence Thomas, who had never argued a case before the Supreme Court, had not been a judge for more than 16 months. Like, if you look back on another vacancy that arose within about a year of the end of a president's term, you know, a very different posture. But President Obama's nominee is a former prosecutor. He's not a liberal. He's not a progressive. And I think that is part of the gamut to say to some subset of the Republican senators, this is the best deal you're going to get in terms of appointment to the court. And some of those senators are expressing a little bit of weakness. And certainly you can see the ads running by the Democratic Party in the Senate races in this state and other states that they're trying to focus on this idea of these do your job to really put pressure on these senators. But you have a senator in Iowa, Senator Grassley, who's been there for a long time, who didn't think he was going to have much of a race for re-election yet again. And he has stood right by the corrupt Senator McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, and McConnell's corrupt for a number of reasons, but Grassley has stood right beside him, saying he's not going to give President Obama's nominee, and you know it's not going to happen. And I think, quite frankly, that level of politicization of the court is exceptional and extraordinary in American history, certainly in modern American history, especially when you had Democrats who so willingly, and I, you know, from my standpoint, I regrettably were so willing to confirm so many of the extreme nominees of President Reagan and President the first President Bush and the second President Bush. But I think that it's true that for Democrats the courts haven't resonated as much. And I've thought about this a lot as someone who's worked on judicial nominations and has studied this for, you know, more than 20 years. In part, that's because the Democrats approach the courts as places where they want judges to be fair and neutral magistrates, which is the sort of ideal world or vision of a judge. They're neutral, you get a fair shake. The Republicans approach the judiciary in the states, the Supreme Court here in Wisconsin, and states across the country, and the U.S. Supreme Court as another political player for them to basically win victories for their side. And so they're willing to invest a lot more capital in getting their person through and pushing for the most extreme, most ideological, most dependable right winger they can, and you don't see that type of rhetoric on the left. I mean, and you don't see it on the moderates in the Democratic Party, and that creates a situation that is tremendously out of balance. One of the things that happened when Clinton came in after 12 years of Reagan-Bush was that instead of doing a counterweight of really a strong bench of progressive judges to be a counterweight to the extreme conservatives that Reagan put on, instead he said, no, that's not the right way. We're going to appoint moderates. We need, you know, fair judges, not ideological judges. And that's predominantly what they did. Of course, the Republicans claimed that they were all lefties anyway. Wasn't true. A lot of them were former prosecutors, former big firm partners. But the fact is that the Republicans play hardball for these judicial seats, and the Democrats over time typically have not. And I think it's partly because of a difference in point of view about the courts. But just to sum up, I would say there's no doubt that this Supreme Court is going to make decisive rulings about our future and even our capacity and ability to deal with the devastating changes to climate through climate change that our planet is already incurring. And if this court falls to the far right, we may have no capacity to pass laws to overcome their decisions ruling unconstitutional our efforts to regulate these big corporations and these big polluters to protect ourselves from the devastating consequences of climate change.
But you also said that in President Bill Clinton, in putting up these moderate candidates instead of, because frankly there are no liberals on the Supreme Court in the tradition of William O. Douglas and Thurgood Marshall, etc. I mean, it's a joke that, you know, they're far right, and then basically moderate. So already the goalposts have been moved, and you said that Clinton, not only did he not go for really liberal judges to counterweight the far right drift, he also made some compromise with Orrin Hatch to make sure that they were older justices so they wouldn't be around that long. And whereas everybody that the Republicans have put in have been very young, with Alito and Roberts being the latest, but then Thomas earlier as an example. Now, the Thomas case came back in the form of an HBO movie. And even though there was screaming from the right wing about a character assassination and the liberal Hollywood crowd, you know, playing their usual games as far as the conservatives are concerned, rewriting history. But frankly, what I got from that was exactly what you just said. It came across very clearly to me that this is about the asymmetry between the Republicans and the Democrats. The Republicans are absolutely ruthless. They didn't care that this guy was all this evidence against him. It didn't matter. They wanted their guy. They want to win, and they'll win at all costs. On the Democratic side, with Joe Biden equivocating and being the nice guy and giving them all the breaks, etc., what happened? At the end of the day, this guy, who is probably one of the least qualified people that ever sat on that court, is there, and he's there forever.
Yeah, I mean, I watched that movie, and it was actually painful to watch. I went to law school as the hearings were unfolding. It was just coming out of law school as that was happening, and it was stunning to experience at the time to watch those hearings and to see how they treated Anita Hill, to see Clarence Thomas lie and dissemble about the fact that he didn't have views on things, the many claims he made, including the effort to portray the fact that he was being questioned about an African-American woman accusing him of grotesque sexual harassment, to try to claim that was a high-tech lynching and that it was all racist was really absurd. But he played that card, and the Democrats, a number of them blinked, and Joe Biden did not put on another witness to back up Anita Hill, another woman who had been victimized by Clarence Thomas. I think that was a terrible strategic error. It was a terrible failure, and it left us with someone on the court who was unfit to begin with and has demonstrated his profound unfitness in so many ways since he's been on the court, including his close association with the Koch brothers, going to their Freedom Partners billionaire party. And hanging out with them, and his wife's really unseemly behavior, really advancing the interests of the Tea Party, while being married to the Supreme Court justice, the incredible level of her engagement in the efforts to kill the Affordable Care Act, even though obviously it was a compromise and didn't get us the type of single-payer program that we really need in this country, her political involvement, documents that came out a couple years ago about her role really working with the senator's staff and the Republican senators in the United States Senate on her political agenda is extraordinary. And he failed to report her income. And you know, his financial filings, I think, are suspect at best. So you have someone on the Supreme Court who is one's undeserving to begin with and has demonstrated his extraordinary closed-mindedness. One of the things about Thomas that I'll never forget is the fact that at one point he issued a decision in which he said that the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment only applies to punishment that is cruel and unusual. And he said, and unusual. So it could be cruel, that's fine, or unusual, but not both. This is this literalist BS. But then he had the audacity to say that under his interpretation of the Eighth Amendment, the only punishment that's prohibited is the sentence that you get. How you're treated once you're behind bars is not a constitutional concern. His callousness and disregard for other human beings is profound and manifest. And if I were in charge, I think he should be impeached. He should not be sitting on that court.
Well, just in closing, though, in terms of the charges against the accuracy of that film, what came across to me was that as soon as Anita Hill testified, Bush and the White House people were done because she was so convincing. And rather than that moment, the Democrats counterattack or buttress her, they folded when the Republicans counterattacked. And that was the key moment. So do you think that by folding as Biden did, that had he not folded, had that other witness come on, because I guess the bottom line is, do you think it's accurate that once she testified that the Bush White House figured, my God, this guy's not going to make it? And he squeaked by with, 2-3 votes. So do you think that's accurate?
I think that's accurate. And I think that, there were senators like the senator I worked for, Senator Patrick Leahy, who stood up and said no to Clarence Thomas. And there were many others, nearly half of the Senate said no to Clarence Thomas. Unfortunately, there were some Southern Democrats like Sam Nunn and others who basically were going to stand with Clarence Thomas. It was going to be a difficult vote. But I am convinced that had they put on a second woman to testify similarly, that would have been the end of Clarence Thomas's legal career. He would not be on the bench, and they would have had to put forward a much less hostile candidate, hostile to civil rights, a much more qualified candidate for that court. And we wouldn't have the type of ridiculous opinions that Thomas has written over and over and over again, many of which he concurred with Justice Scalia on, who was an extreme judge who, quite frankly, operated on the bench like a talk show host, basically, in terms of his legal analysis and his attacking of legitimate and reasonable interpretations. And so I think it was a missed opportunity. I think it's a tragedy that Thomas was allowed to be confirmed, and that Joe Biden, quite frankly, with all due respect to the other good things he's done, that he did not call that other woman, the witness, who could have really cemented for the American people how much Thomas had abused his power, how unfit he was for the court.
Well, Lisa Graves, I thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who's Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of ALEC-Exposed.org. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. Where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.